From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. A local hospital expands its residential OCD program to treat growing needs. Later, how nurse-managed clinics are changing the healthcare scene in Milwaukee.
Nurse practitioner-led clinics are very successful across the country and actually has very high customer satisfaction because there's something special about the relationship between a nurse and a patient.
Plus, a year in the life of a Wisconsin farm chronicled by a Madison photographer.
It was a tough kind of beauty, and I thought of that phrase a lot when I went to the farm. The days were long, but the trade-off was the beauty, the animals, and the land.
And the author of The Testing says, dystopian setting aside, her fiction is part of a long tradition of coming-of-age novels. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is one of the better-known psychological diseases out there, thanks in no small part to its frequent depiction on screen. From the TV characters Monk and Girls Hannah to Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets, OCD is often played up for comedic and dramatic purposes. But OCD is a real-life issue affecting more than 2 million American adults, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. Some estimates say almost 500,000 children have it, and more people are being diagnosed each year. To help meet OCD patients' growing needs, Oconomowoc's Rogers Memorial Hospital opened a new expanded residential treatment center last month. Rogers has one of the largest and most comprehensive OCD programs in the world. Clinical director Dr. Brad Riemann, a leading expert in anxiety disorders like OCD, joins me in studio to talk about why such a facility was needed. Dr. Riemann, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be back.
Well, I want to start by having you talk about what obsessive-compulsive disorder really looks like and just how serious of a problem it can be for patients who are suffering from the disorder.
Yeah, obsessive-compulsive disorder actually is the fourth most common psychiatric condition that we have in the United States. So it's very, very common, typically characterized by what are called obsessions, which are these unwanted thoughts, images, or impulses that generate high levels of anxiety. Common examples might be the fear of becoming dirty or contaminated, doubting whether you did something or did something correctly. Did I lock the door? Did I turn off the stove? Compulsions, on the other hand, are some sort of repetitive act. It could be another mental act. It could be another thought or some sort of behavioral act that is done to try to neutralize that bad obsessional thought or try to get rid of the anxiety that it causes or somehow prevent a bad event from occurring. So in response to contamination, you get washing and cleaning. In response to doubting, you will get checking the door, checking to make sure the stove is off and so forth. And there's many, many other examples. Unfortunately, not only is OCD common, but it is also very debilitating. For the most part, it affects really every aspect of someone's life.
I wonder if it's difficult sometimes to really communicate how debilitating OCD can be when we have depictions of it in the media that probably are pretty imprecise. People kind of throw around self-diagnosing, oh, I'm so OCD about that. Eminem is talking about his OCD in a new pop song. Does that make your job harder?
Yeah, that's a great question. It can. I mean, first of all, OCD is a fairly commonly misdiagnosed and misdefined condition. Kind of the public's perception is anybody who thinks about anything a lot must have OCD. Just because you think about something a lot or just because you do something over and over again doesn't necessarily mean you have OCD. Obsessions, again, are these unwanted anxiety-producing thoughts. So one of the common ways that it can be misdiagnosed or misdefined is, say, someone will get a call saying, oh, my son has OCD. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. What type of problems does he have? He can't stop playing video games. Now, here's a person who's thinking about video games a lot, playing them maybe 10, 12 hours a day, which is a problem, no doubt, but it's almost the opposite problem. When you ask Johnny, do you like to think about playing video games? Oh, yes, love it. Oh, you know, that's my favorite thing in the world. Do you like playing them? Yep. The only time I get anxious is if my parents tell me not to do it. Whereas if you talk to somebody with OCD about their obsessional thoughts, their fears of contamination or doubt, These are very unwanted thoughts. They're very anxiety-producing thoughts. They would really like to get rid of them. If you ask somebody, do you like or enjoy washing or checking or praying or counting over and over again, they would say no, and what can you do to help me stop? So, you know, the term obsession in particular is something that's just kind of morphed into something that, it, from a psychiatric standpoint, it truly is not. And certainly, you know, people who may think about kind of the classic things about, well, I like to be cleanly or I like to be orderly. You know, those people, of course, are going to rarely kind of seek treatment. But overall, the public awareness of OCD, though, is so much greater than it was 20 years ago. And in a way, some of those misperceptions, I think, helps increase some awareness. But we better make sure of our diagnosis before we start treating, that's for sure.
Now, Rogers already had one of the largest and most comprehensive programs to treat OCD in-house. Why open this brand new facility?
Yeah, it's a great question. Need. I mean, that's the simple answer to it. As we mentioned before, obsessive compulsive disorder is a very common problem. Unfortunately, there are not very many centers of excellence set up to treat it. It's one of these things where if treated properly, in the vast majority of cases, it can be treated quite effectively, but there aren't many places set up to do that. This particular center, we just had exceeded the space that we had, the capacity that we had, and we were very, very fortunate that this property just came up very near where we already were. In addition to kind of expanding the amount of space, we were also able to kind of go in and completely redo it to just really meet our residents and our patients' needs. So it is really set up specifically to help us treat this condition.
This is the third expansion of the program since it was opened in 1999. Why do you think the need is growing so much? Is it because that public awareness is growing and maybe more people feel more comfortable coming forward to be treated for it? What's going on?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I don't think there's necessarily any reason to believe that there are more people with OCD now than there was 20 years ago, but there's clearly a greater public awareness. You know, there have been several television shows focusing in on characters with OCD and even reality shows, and these things have increased awareness. People with OCD are very embarrassed by their symptoms typically. And I think some of these programs may have helped them to kind of step forward and say, hey, look, you know, I think I have this problem, and they kind of reach out for help. So I think it's really just more of an issue of awareness and willingness to come into treatment, knowing that there is effective care.
Now, this facility will be able to treat 28 patients in-house. Why is it so important to have that residential treatment versus just having someone come in for appointments?
Yeah, the residential level of care is really meant for the most severe and complicated cases. Thankfully, the vast majority of people with OCD do not warrant this level of care, but perhaps as many as 10% of people with OCD do. These are individuals whose lives have basically stopped. They are being plagued by so many obsessions and compulsions that they're not able to function in school or at work or in their relationships, and really just need assistance 24 hours a day to function. They may need assistance eating. They may need assistance getting dressed, and just that support, and whether it's medical support, whether it's psychiatric support. And so it's really for the profoundly disabled cases. Typically, the vast majority of people can get by with lower levels of care.
Does Rogers also provide that at a different level?
Yeah, we provide treatment at the intensive outpatient level, which is really kind of set up for the vast majority of people with OCD. Kind of moderate up to severe cases are treated in the intensive outpatient. We also have what's called day treatment, where people really spend the entire day with us, but then they return home at night. This is really meant for kind of severe cases. And then the residential, where these people need, again, this assistance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, are really set up for kind of the extreme cases. So we have really all of the levels of care covered, and really all of the different ages. So we provide the same levels of care for children and adolescents as well as adults.
That's shocking to hear. You often think about OCD as something manifesting in adults. You don't often hear about it in children.
Yeah, it's unfortunately very common in kids. It's not quite known exactly how common, but probably 1% of children will be dealing with OCD. It seems that there's kind of almost two common ages of onset for the condition. One is somewhere around 8, 9, 10 years of age, And then things, for the at least on average, kind of tend to mellow out. And then again, around 20 or so is another kind of area of common onset. It really can hit people pretty much at any age, but unfortunately, kids are not immune to this.
How do you help these patients, especially with something that seems like it's taking over your life?
Yeah. The really good news is OCD is a very treatable condition when treated properly. The window of effectiveness of that treatment, however, is pretty small. But if you get in that, very good things are going to happen. Even if you're just a little outside of that window, things tend to stall pretty quickly. But the treatment of choice for OCD is something called exposure and ritual prevention. We had mentioned OCD really has kind of two parts, the obsessions and the compulsions. And as a result, the treatment really has two parts as well. Exposure targets the obsessional thoughts. Ritual prevention obviously targets those rituals or compulsions. And in a nutshell, what exposure and ritual prevention is a series of very individualized exposure assignments where we are going to be asking someone kind of in a very gradual, repetitive fashion to kind of reintroduce themselves into their feared situations and then not do their typical normal ritual, whether it's a mental compulsion or a behavioral compulsion, following that. So for an example, we talked about contamination before. People with the fear of becoming dirty or contaminated commonly won't be able to touch things in their normal daily environment. So maybe they avoid touching doorknobs. And if they do touch a doorknob, commonly they'll have to go wash. So the obsession is this fear of becoming contaminated, say, by the HIV virus. And the ritual would normally be, washing and scrubbing of the hands, sanitizing the hands, whatever it may be. In an exposure and ritual prevention model, we would ask someone to begin to touch doorknobs and not wash their hands. Now, obviously, that is far, far easier said than done. And there is a real kind of method to the madness, if you will, as to how you kind of lead up to that point. Bottom line is again, sticking with our doorknob example, there are doorknobs that are far harder for someone to come in contact with and not wash their hands than others. We would start with these perceived easier doorknobs. An example might be their bedroom doorknob versus their little brother's bedroom doorknob, which they think is dirtier because he's always wiping at his nose or something like that, versus, of course, a bathroom doorknob versus something that would be out in public. So there's all these different steps. There might be 10 different doorknob exercises, for example, getting to the point finally of being able to use really any doorknob like anyone else would.
The message you're giving is this is treatable. This is something that doesn't have to run your life.
Correct. As we said, it's a very common problem, a very debilitating problem, but also a very treatable problem. The biggest concern for someone with OCD is just really trying to find somebody who knows how to do this. And unfortunately, that is the number one disadvantage of this type of treatment, just trying to find providers who are trained and experienced in doing this. Believe it or not, we probably have anywhere from 85 to 90 people with OCD on our campus from the ages of 8 to 80 today, from all over the place, and that is because of a lack of providers. And one of the things that myself and some of my professional colleagues have really tried to do over the last 10 to 20 years is expand that, try to do a lot of trainings. We'll be going to Tampa, Florida here in a couple of weeks and doing a training for professionals, licensed professionals in the state of Florida because there's no reason to be competitive about this. There is way too much suffering going on and too few providers.
You mentioned before that you've taken that accumulated experience and knowledge and treatment know-how and used that to inform how you designed this facility.
Yes. We mentioned before that people with OCD are embarrassed by their symptoms, and as a result, they can also be embarrassed by their treatment. Meaning, if you're going to have people going around and touching these certain things or doing certain things, they do like privacy. And in the design of the Cedar Ridge facility, there are far more what we kind of call breakout offices for people to kind of go in and do this work with clinicians, but in private, which is important for them. We want to make sure that we respect their dignity and try to do this in the most humane way possible, and that is in part by giving them their own space to get this work done.
And now you have it.
And now we have it, and we're thrilled.
Well, Dr. Brad Riemann, thank you so much again for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Brad Riemann is the clinical director of the OCD Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital based in Oconomowoc. Its new residential treatment facility in Summit for OCD patients opened last month. A quick break now, and in just a moment, how nurse-managed clinics can help bring healthcare to some of Milwaukee's neediest communities. That's next on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Two new primary care health clinics opened in Milwaukee in the last several months, and while they're much-needed additions to their neighborhood's sparse healthcare landscapes, they're also a little different. They're run by nurses. A partnership between Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and Marquette University's College of Nursing created the two clinics, one at Milwaukee's Northside YMCA, the other at the COA Golden Center on the city's north side. Children's Hospital CEO Peggy Troy and the college's dean, Margaret Callahan, joined me in the studio to talk more about the clinics and improving community health in Milwaukee. Peggy and Margaret, welcome back to Lake Effect.
We're so glad to be here today.
Absolutely.
Why did you decide on these two particular locations?
Really, the way this whole process started was really the good work that Children's Hospital of Wisconsin had done, getting a good sense in our community, what were the neighborhoods of greatest need. And so they spent quite a bit of time talking to the communities, finding out what the community wanted. And we were fortunate in Marquette Nursing that Children's then came to us and asked us to partner with them. So our first clinic opened at the COA Golden Center, and already we have patients that are being seen. We've had our nurse practitioners just be so excited to be part of the community, to be present there. And I think it's a wonderful relationship in a community that really needs primary care providers.
The other thing we did that was really important as we looked is, first of all, we looked at where the greatest health disparities are, because we really believe that we've got to make an investment in the population health of our community, the health of the population. So we looked at where we had the worst health disparities, because our board of trustees had said, we want the children of Wisconsin to be the healthiest in the nation. And we stack up to about the 50th percentile if you look across the state. But when you get to the central city of Milwaukee, we drop to the fourth worst in the country in outcomes and health for kids. So we looked by zip code where those neighborhoods with the greatest opportunity were located. But we knew we couldn't just put a clinic in a community. I mean, that's one of the, I think, things that healthcare providers often think they know more and better than the community they serve. And so we actually went out and worked with the citizens of that community and said, what do you need? What do you want? How can we be helpful? The other thing we said is we have to have great partners. And so that's why the COA and Northside YMCA, instead of a freestanding clinic, became clear. And the thing that was so wonderful about this partnership with Marquette is that the neighbors in the Golan Heights area said, Imani Heights, said, but we have to have care for the caregivers. And that threw us for a little bit of a lurch in the beginning, because we do pediatric care.
I was going to say, that seems kind of like an interesting order for Children's Hospital to be caring for adult caregivers.
Well, because the caregivers said to us, if we're not healthy ourselves, how can we give, you know, the great guidance and care to our kids? And then along came Margaret.
I say this really with all sincerity. The window opened for me. You know, it was the opportunity to do something different, to do something meaningful, provide an opportunity not only for our nurse practitioners who really love to provide this type of care, but for our students. Because what we know is that if students don't see practice like this in a community, they'll never want to work there. And in the future, what we also know is a large part of healthcare will be delivered outside of hospitals. We need to work with a broader perspective, just from, you know, preventing colds and flus. We need to start talking and working in communities about things like poverty and access to jobs and all of those kinds of things. And I am so excited, not only for the care we'll provide in the clinic, but for our students who will be able to work with the staffs of both of these centers, identifying the kinds of things they want, health fairs, all sorts of kinds of wellness activities. So we see this as the first step into a much deeper relationship in both of these communities.
Well, so let me ask, it may seem self-explanatory, the idea of a nurse-managed clinic, but what work is actually going to be able to be done in these two locations by being managed by nurses from Marquette with the partners that Children's is working with?
Well, I'm going to start out and then I'm going to let Margaret talk for a minute. But this is one of our projects of innovation. And we know that nurse practitioner-led clinics are very successful across the country and actually has very high customer satisfaction because Margaret and I are both nurses. So we can say there's something special about the relationship between a nurse and a patient. And so these clinics are comprehensive. They're able to do diagnosis and treatment. Now, there is a point at which they need to make referrals because it's a higher level of care. But for many of the things that are going to occur in the clinic relative to the health needs, the nurse practitioners are very well trained and very capable of taking care of the health needs of the community. They'll plug into us. They'll plug into the adult systems in town. So as patients absolutely need to go to that higher level of care, they're going to have the referral patterns and things. But it really is a neighborhood-based clinic that really does allow it. And this is a model of the future. Nurse practitioners, and I'm so glad that we have such a great training program at Marquette because, you know, we have about 150 nurse practitioners at Children's because we really know that in many cases they do a very capable job and they're supervised by physicians so that there is that oversight. But a lot of the care that they deliver is through protocols and through best practices and care pathways, and it just works.
That's right. No, that's right, Peggy. I think the important thing that Peggy mentioned is this is really based on data. We have great evidence nationwide about how nurse practitioners can really do a very good job. And we know not only from what we've done at Marquette and what we see our nurse practitioners doing at Children's that nurse practitioners provide exceptional care.
I want to add on to something Margaret said because I think it's really important and why we want to be in neighborhoods. When we look at the data that's published in the literature, health care delivery only determines about 20% of an individual's health status. It's poverty. It's access to good food. It's safety. It's security. It's education. There are about 20 other determinants of health care that we have to take into consideration. So when you're in a neighborhood, you know where there is or isn't fresh food. You know what resources are available to those families for a myriad of things that they're struggling with. And so we've been also developing relationships with Housing and Urban Development, the police department, and others, so that as we understand better what the comprehensive needs are of those individuals, you know, along with the Golan Center and the YMCA, we can then begin to build the competencies those families need to develop themselves in order for them to be successful themselves and also to successfully raise their children.
This seems like a really holistic approach.
It's very holistic. And I think one of the things that our nurse practitioners are so excited about is being at COA Golden and at the Y, because so much of what we would want to do in terms of best practice for our clients, our patients, might be as simple as saying, you know, we have to get you going on an exercise regimen. And that's a really hard thing to say to a patient if they have no hopes of ever getting into a health club or a health facility. The beauty of this relationship, both of these sites have those kinds of resources available. So our nurse practitioners now can not only say, well, we'll take care of the issue that you came to see us with today, a fever. But, you know, I've also noticed that, you know, your weight's a little bit up. You told me that you're not really very good at exercising. I want you to go around the corner and go down here and start investigating the programs that COA Golden has or the Y has with regard to exercise and wellness. So having those resources there in the community for us to call on, it's really a very unique model. And we're really excited. We're also excited that we're going to be collecting data on this. We're going to be studying our impact in the community in concert with the staff and the programming of both of these centers. So we are going to be able to demonstrate our effectiveness. And I think that will not only tell us that we're doing a good job right here in inner city Milwaukee, but I firmly believe that this will be a model we'll be able to demonstrate could be moved to other places, not only in Milwaukee, but around the country.
I wonder if this isn't part of a trend where nurse-managed clinics are becoming more popular. And I wonder, was there an impact when the Affordable Care Act went into law? Has that impacted it at all?
No, this is just really, you know, so what's happening across the country, Stephanie, is that, and I talk to employers all the time, nobody wants to pay more for their health care, right? And they really want value-based health care. So I can tell you a lot of this work was in development. And of course, the Affordable Care Act, because the conversation now is all about healthcare, right? It probably accelerated it, but this trend has been emerging because the difference is, you know, the healthcare spend in the United States of America is 18% of the GDP. Back when in the 90s, when they started the healthcare, let's look at it and see what we can do, it was 11%. So the enormous growth in the actual spend of healthcare, I think, has really been the driving force. And employers saying, help, you know, we need to get value-based healthcare. So I think it was, to me, an evolution of many different aspects that came together. And I think there's a huge accountability on us in healthcare to make sure that we're looking at the most efficient, effective ways to deliver the best outcomes. And while this isn't the only way and is part of an ecosystem, it's a very important way. And it's something that the community actually embraces. We will continue to work with the neighbors who helped us get to this point because we have three neighborhood groups. We've got one at the Golan Heights. We've got one at the YMCA. And we're also at the Next Door Foundation with a similar model. And, you know, they're going to continue to inform and advise us about what else they need. And back to Margaret's point, I mean, right now, Tom Schneider at Golan Heights, one of the big, big things that the community lacks is access to fresh food. You can't imagine how hard it is to find an apple or a banana. We did a little study, and it costs more to buy an apple or banana in those neighborhoods than it does out in Waukesha County because the access to it. So he's out now trying to source a grocery store, you know, to come and be an anchor store that would then allow people to get fresh foods, and he has cooking classes that teach. So we, like I said, it's an ecosystem of support and services to try to get people towards health.
Are there markers you're trying to accomplish, specific community health goals?
Yeah, and let me tell you, because when our board of trustees 3 or 4 years ago said, you know, we're going to adopt the vision that we want the children of Wisconsin to be the healthiest in the nation, we looked at about 50 different determinants of health outcomes. And we said we've got to pick some that really would indicate that the health of the population is improving. So we're looking at things like immunization rates, infant mortality, asthma admissions to the hospital that are really, again, they're not the only indicators, but they do really give you a little deeper insight into what is really going on with the overall health.
I think the other thing is some of the things that we'll be looking at will be very simple, and we'll start to know it very soon. I talked to our nurse manager. They're seeing patients that haven't had a connection to healthcare in years because they couldn't access it. We're already recognizing we're making an impact. And I think that that's only going to be, as Peggy said, one small measure of our overall outcome.
And I wanted to ask about that, Margaret. You had talked before about the importance of making sure this is a sustainable model in the community, because isn't that funding issue part of what's driven out healthcare in these communities, that primary care doctors just really can't afford to stay in these communities where you have high rates of Medicare, Medicaid, and low reimbursement rates?
That's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that we know is current reimbursement for these populations is lower than the actual cost of operating these systems. But the beauty of a nurse-managed center, for example, is that we can do this at a decreased rate, number one. But most importantly here is the fact that Children's Hospital of Wisconsin has set this as a priority, as a goal.
Right now, the way that the health system works, I mean, you're incentivized to make sure that kids get admitted to the hospital and, you know, get lots of care. But at the end of the day, I really truly believe as the healthcare conversation keeps evolving over the next many years, there is going to be incentives for performance around keeping people out of expensive healthcare. And we're already starting to see examples of that across the country. So, you know, it is an investment. It is innovation. But again, you put the stake in the ground, and we said we wanted the health of the children to be the best, not just the health care. you know, we're trying to do our part to change the course and get that care closer to home.
Peggy Troy is the president and CEO of Children's Hospital and Health System. Margaret Callahan is the dean of the College of Nursing at Marquette University. The organizations have collaborated with Milwaukee's Northside YMCA and the COA Golden Center to open two new nurse-managed community health clinics. You can learn more about the clinics from a report by Aaron Toner of the WUWM Newsroom. You can find that at WUWM.com. While there aren't as many small family farms as there used to be in Wisconsin, there is still a distinctive way of life on the farm. A photographer tries to open a window into that life when we return on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Sometimes during the hustle and bustle of the city life, people need to escape. Some escape to the country roads of Wisconsin looking for that serenity. Photojournalist Craig Schreiner went looking for a picture for a story, and he turned to the country. Serendipity came into play when he saw a farmer baling hay one late afternoon. He got out, captured the moment, and made a new friend out of the farmer, Jim Lamberty. After a year's worth of photographing Lamberty and his family's daily life, Schreiner compiled his book, One Small Farm, Photographs of a Wisconsin Way of Life. Schreiner spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson about how this project came to be.
Well, I was actually looking for a photo for a Saturday newspaper, and I worked at the Wisconsin State Journal at the time, and sometimes stories just don't have pictures to go with them. They're stories about meetings or non-visual stories, and we need a picture to stand by itself to kind of anchor a page and be of interest to readers. So photojournalists go out and try to find those pictures, and it's a challenge to find good ones, because if you can't find anything compelling or visual, it's just filler, and we don't like that. So I was looking, and I often go outside the city to the country to look, and it was late afternoon, and I had just turned onto a small county road, and I saw a man baling hay in a field. It was a sight that was somewhat reminiscent to me from my childhood growing up on a farm. He was using older equipment and pulling a baler and baling the smaller oblong bale that you don't see a lot of these days. You tend to see the giant round bales sitting out in the field. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a beautiful sight. He was on a hillside, and it was late afternoon, and the sun was getting kind of golden and rosy, and I stopped to photograph, and he saw me, and he may have waved at me a little bit, but he just kept right on. And so I made the pictures, and then he finished baling, and we stopped and talked, and he told me his story. The story was that he and his brother had grown up on this farm all their lives. It was 180 acres, and they have 40 dairy cows, and started by their parents. Their mother was still living on the farm with them, and that's the way they'd been living all of their lives. And something just made me instinctively ask, can I come to the farm and spend time and photograph you? And that was Jim, mm-hmm. Jim Lamberty, and his response was, sure, come anytime. And that's how it started. Didn't actually get there until the following February.
So it was, I think I saw that the pictures were from 2010, so this would have been 2009?
Yes, we met in 2009, and we started working on the project in 2010 in the winter.
So what was it that made you stick with the Lambertys instead of just moving on to some other project?
Well, I think because of my own background, my awareness of farming and what I knew about farming and farmers and how it's changing, something just told me that this was special and something that I wanted to spend time with.
So then what did it entail for you to follow this farming family around throughout the entire year?
It did take a little bit of perseverance. I still had to work full-time at my regular newspaper job. I also teach photojournalism at the local technical college, and I wanted to try to be part of my children's lives and my wife's life, too. So I was in and out of the Lamberty farm just pretty frequently over a year and a half. I would go to try to document significant things. I would be in touch with Jim and Gordy by phone, find out what they were doing. And I would just stop at the farm as much as I could.
Because with a lot of these pictures, they're milking the cows, and they milk in the morning and they milk at night. So you must have been out there pretty early.
That's right. A lot of it always started before sunrise and ended after sunset. That was their life, not my life. It was that routine for them 365 days a year. When I first met them, they had never had a vacation. I got to think of it as, well, the more time I spent with them, it reminded me of something that I read once. Let me just back up a little farther. Something that I heard in a radio interview once with the author Norman McLean, who the listeners may know as being the author of A River Runs Through It. It was made into a movie in the 90s, I think. But in this radio interview, he talked about growing up, his own boyhood in Montana, and he used the words toughness and beauty together in a sentence. And he said something like, it was a tough kind of beauty. And I thought of that phrase a lot when I went to the farm, because that really was their life. The days were long. There was really no leisure time as we know leisure time, but the trade-off was the beauty, the animals, and the land.
So then, as a photojournalist, what is the difference between capturing rural scenes versus capturing the urban scenes? Because I can see with both places, there is a tough kind of beauty to each one, but what is it about you wanting to photograph real version of the tough kind of beauty?
Well, I'm just always interested in people, rural people, urban people. They all have their stories. Everybody has a story. This was a unique story to me, but I've always been motivated by people's stories. Oftentimes, there are stories of people who are trying to overcome something in their lives, something that's happening to them that they're trying to recover from and prevail and persevere. And those are the kinds of stories that really appeal to me. This had a country element, a rural element, but it was a unique story about people in the same way that a lot of stories are.
And with these stories, especially with this one, the One Small Farm book that you've compiled, there are a lot of strong themes. And one of the strongest themes is the idea of nostalgia and tradition. And when you were talking about how you came across the Lamberty farm and he was using this old equipment, that it just as an example of nostalgia and tradition. But with this farming family, living at home with their mother, continued to do the same work with the same equipment that their father used nearly 60 years ago. With one of the photo captions, you say that their methods are traditional and labor intensive. So why aren't they changing the technology that they use? Wouldn't it make it easier for them to do their work?
Well, I don't think so. I think they would be the first to say that their equipment really fit the size of the farm. You would not need a 22-row planter on a 180-acre farm. And they'd be the first to tell you that nostalgia is not the reason they do what they do. They have a mix of equipment, some of the equipment, the tractors their father had, and that means a lot to them. They do have an attachment, a sentimental attachment to the equipment, but that's not why they have used it on the farm. It's practical, it's functional, and it's what they choose to do.
And what I like about that is that they can fix almost all their mechanical problems actually on the farm. And they have the skills to be able to repair the machines. And with the clothes, there are some pictures in here where you take pictures of Marie's jacket or Jim's jacket where the patches are just all over the jacket. And I find that fascinating. Instead of getting new clothes, they're fixing it up. They're fixing up what they had.
The work clothes are for work, mm-hmm. and very little was discarded. Thrift and avoiding debt is a very important part of their success.
With one of the prominent quotations in the book is, people's lives are written on the fields of the old farms. What story is this book telling?
It's a book about work, mainly, and their attachment to the land that they grew up on. The story is about care for land and care for animals mm-hmm. in a very personal but a practical way.
And with the epilogue, you said that you followed up with them, and at that point they had decided to sell off their dairy cows.
In late September of 2012, they found a young farmer from near Darlington who was looking to take on a dairy herd and found the financing to buy the cows. And they had the Lambertys wanted to keep the herd together. They had decided this was a long decision, and I remember this coming up from time to time when I would be there, that it was time to sell the dairy herd because of health reasons. And then this was nothing catastrophic. It was just that it was just years and years of long work, long hours. It's hard on the body. It's hard on the back. It's hard on the knees. It's tough work. So Jim and Gordy were looking to sell the herd. In 2012, the drought hit and made it impractical because of the drought, farmers were having a hard time finding feed for cattle. Feed was very expensive, and livestock was being sold very cheaply. But Jim and Gordy had worked so long at putting this herd together, and they'd taken such good care of it, they weren't going to split it up, and they didn't want to let it go cheaply. But in September of 2012, they were surprised when a young farmer contacted them. He was from near Darlington. He wanted to start a herd, and do the same thing, kinds of things with it that they had done. He obtained the financing, and so they did sell the herd at that time. However, they're feeding young stock, Holstein heifers and steers, which are raised as beef cattle and not dairy cattle. And so they're a lot less labor intensive.
Putting in that epilogue, it kind of shows that you still follow up. What are the Lambertys doing nowadays?
I do. I was there a few weeks ago when they were baling hay. They're primarily crop farming and feeding their stock for their beef cattle. The daily milkings, of course, are not going on anymore, but the farm is still going on.
Have they taken a vacation yet?
Well, Gordy and Vicky have taken a couple of vacations. Jim and Gordy have gone fishing. Jim goes to Madison to a Mallards game now and then, a baseball game. And so, they're finding some time to enjoy their lives and get away from time to time.
Good. And then what's new with you? What's going to happen with you next?
Well, I'm nothing like this book has really ever happened to me before, and I'm just kind of enjoying that for now. We had a reception to launch the book a couple of weeks ago at the community center in Pine Bluff, which is near the farm, and a lot of the Lambertys friends and relatives from years back just came to honor them and to just kind of it was an occasion for celebration. And I'm just happy for whatever good can come from this. I'm happy that the story is preserved.
Photojournalist Craig Schreiner spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson about his new book, One Small Farm, Photographs of a Wisconsin Way of Life. We'll take one last break, and then, have you ever felt like your whole life depended on the outcome of one exam? That's literally the case in a new book, The Testing. We'll talk to the author when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. UWM students still have a couple of weeks to relax before the semester begins, but in the minds of many high school students, they've got it made. After all, they're already in college. The next several months will be a waiting game for many high school seniors as they hope to get into the colleges of their dreams, with the pressure to get accepted mounting. What if there were a test that would not only determine whether you would go to university, but also the direction of the rest of your life? No, we're not talking about the ACTs here, but rather the subject of author Joelle Charbonneau's young adult dystopian novel, The Testing. It's the first in a trilogy. The second installment, Independent Study, is just out this month. Back in August, the Chicago area writer told me what inspired the story.
I teach. I'm a private voice teacher, so I have a lot of high school students. And every year I work with them on getting them ready for their college application process, getting them ready for their auditions. And every year it gets a little more difficult. What used to be 3 to 4 schools they had to audition at, now it's sometimes 10 to 12 to get into a top school. And some of my students do better with the stress than others, some don't. And a couple of years ago, one of my students was starting to melt down a little bit about the stress of it all. And I told her, don't worry, this is the worst I've seen it. I can't imagine it's going to get any worse. After I was done saying that, I went, gee, I wonder what would be worse to get into college. I hoped to set it in a contemporary setting, but I couldn't find a way to do what I was kind of looking for. So we had to kind of go far in the future to find a society that might be willing to take testing to a very extreme level.
Tell us a little bit about what's happened to the world and global politics and international relations in our protagonist, Sia's time.
Sia's time is about 100 years after the 7 stages of war, which to me, in my universe, was the first 4 stages are man-made. So it's the world of one by one by one, pulling all the different continents involved until they have gone terribly far and destroyed a whole lot of things. They've dropped a lot of biological and chemical weapons. And in doing so, when they finally decide, oh, wait, we've maybe taken this too far, we're destroying ourselves, and they stop, the Earth then fights back. Put that much chemical, biological warfare into the air and you drop that many bombs, you know, fault lines now have been disturbed. And so there's lots of earthquakes, there's lots of weather changes. And it's 100 years later and they're trying to recolonize and fix what they once broke. So they're trying to clean the water. They're trying to be able to grow things in the ground again. And in Sia's time, they're trying to recolonize like they did the 13 original colonies and bit by bit by bit fix the world.
Well, even though so much is different in Sia's life and in her time, you know, the idea of an adolescent coming into adulthood is still very much the same. And at the beginning of the book, we see Sia going through this kind of adulthood ceremony. And like any teenager, she has dreams for her future. What are Sia's goals?
Sia really wants to be chosen for the testing like her dad was before. Her dad graduated from the university. There is one university and it is located in Tosu City for them, which is Wichita for us. I figured no one would bomb Wichita either. And she desperately wants to be chosen. She wants to be one of the leaders of the country. And that's the one way to be able to get a college education is to be chosen to sit for the testing, which is their version of the SATs, and hopefully get chosen to be one of the next university students and then go on to be one of the country's leaders.
Now, much like you've had to counsel your students, her father takes her aside to counsel her on the testing. What is some of the advice that he gives her that immediately starts to set off her alarm bells?
Well, his main advice is to trust to no one. He does not remember his own testing. They don't believe in the honor system. They remove everybody's memories of that period of time so that way they can't cheat later on and let somebody else know what to expect. At least that's what they say. But he does have really bad nightmares and he vaguely thinks that these are perhaps real memories, but he doesn't really know. So he does warn her that he thinks the testing is more than maybe paper and pencil tests and that there might be bigger consequences to getting a wrong answer and that she should really trust nobody because some people might be out for themselves and be willing to sabotage her in order to be able to get themselves chosen and get a better grade.
Right. She quickly learns once they get to Tosu City and they begin this testing process that it is in fact her worst fear, that there are perhaps sinister forces at work here.
Yes. Not only, you know, the testing officials and what they might be looking for in them, but also their fellow candidates. It's very similar to when I tell my students when they're going to auditions. You never know from one school to another what kind of kids you're going to run into. There's a lot of them that will ask you, so what are you singing for your audition? And a bunch of them, you know, when you answer, will say, oh, well, that's really interesting. You know, they try to psych you out. So there are those kids who feel like if you do a bad job, then they have a better shot of winning, you know, and actually getting what they want, which is acceptance to the university.
Tell me about how you designed the testing and, you know, as you were creating this story and what lines you had to walk in terms of describing certain acts of violence, really, against these young people.
Well, the testing is designed just like the SAT. So there is first the written exam, and it is pencil and paper, and each team is kind of got their own grading system depending on what your skill set is coming in. They like grade you on a curve based on the other people that are in your skill set because they don't expect everybody to be just as good at math as perhaps Sia will be. I probably should never make a character quite so smart again because I had to go back and try to relearn calculus so I could explain it in a very simple way that made a character sound like they understood it. And calculus was not my best subject in high school. She's way smarter than me. But they do warn them that, like the SAT, you are not allowed to guess at times because if you guess, you could be penalized for a wrong answer. In the SAT, they only take off a quarter of a point. In the testing, it might be something far worse.
Like a quarter of your finger.
Yeah, there could be some of your finger, your eye. There are some bad things that happen, but they are given some fair warning. Unfortunately, a lot of them don't listen to it because, like the SAT, I think there's probably a really good inclination for somebody to want to guess and hopefully score that full credit. There's then a hands-on second portion of it. So it's more lab work, you know, how well do you know something? The third round of testing is a team test. How well can you learn about your fellow candidates, judge their skills, as well as how well can you do yourself? And then the fourth test is kind of a practical exam. They want them to see the world that has been destroyed and what is going to be in front of them and be able to kind of survive in that world a little bit and survive their fellow contestants as well.
When Sia's thrown out into the world in Chicago, I couldn't stop myself from thinking, boy, it's kind of like when you graduate from university and you're just, you know, thrown out to the wolves and you got to learn how to do all of this stuff, but to an extreme.
Yes, it is to an extreme. But yeah, there is kind of some of that. Sorry. Parents, it's really not that bad.
I can't help but think that with a teenage protagonist that a lot of young readers would feel a connection with Sia. So what message are we giving them with these kinds of stories of these terrible futures and don't trust adults because they secretly want to weed you out to become robotic leaders?
Not all the adults. There's a lot of good adults. I think that any coming-of-age story, and I mean so many of, I think, the YA fiction that's out there are coming-of-age stories, are really about, you know, teens coming in their own, learning to trust their own opinions, learning to take what they got from their background and from their parents and the things that they've learned, and then look at the world around them and see how it fits. And I think so much of the testing is Sia doing that, because I think so many kids, when they're going off to college, that's what they're really doing. I mean, I watch all my students, you know, I have several of them that are off, going off to college again this year. And really very much it is them, you know, as a member of their family, as a member of their unit, that, you know, and it's a very safe environment, taking everything that they know and have learned and then kind of testing it against the world that they go into. And I think that that is a very common theme I'm learning in young adult fiction, which is makes sense.
You have to wonder, though, what kind of leaders the country is trying to prepare here or select here that could get through a testing like this.
Well, sometimes the person that is supposed to be the president is the one that has to be able to push the button, has to be able to make those terrible choices. And just because they say they can push the button doesn't mean they actually can. Doesn't mean that necessarily you want them as your best friend. You might not want them over for dinner, but they might be the type of person that is able to make a really horrendous, you know, choice that is, you know, not necessarily the choice between a good idea and a bad idea, but between two really bad circumstances, and they have to choose the best one. And sometimes those decisions, you know, are impossible to judge as to what someone will do until you put them in those circumstances.
Now, obviously, the testing is the first in a trilogy.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the other stories without giving too much away, obviously?
Independent study, that is at the university. And it is Sia now after the testing, now trying to – learning more about the world around her, learning more about what is behind the testing, trying to decide if the testing really should continue. There are forces that perhaps want the testing to stop and whether or not she should throw her lot in with them, or if you would rather try to change something from within, you know, be a part of this government that eventually will change something, or does it need to change now? And how much control really – or impact can she have as, you know, a 17-year-old in the middle of the city? And the third book in the trilogy is Graduation Day. There is kind of the theme of just because you graduate doesn't necessarily make you an adult. Sometimes it is the decisions that you are forced to make. And when you step up and not, you know, graduating from the university and being told you're going to be one of the next leaders doesn't necessarily make you a leader. It's making the choices that you need to make and to do what is necessary that sometimes are. And then how far are you willing again to go?
Joelle Charbonneau is the author of The Testing, the first in a trilogy of young adult dystopian novels. The second book, Independent Study, is out this month. A musician, actress, and voice teacher, Charbonneau is also the author of comedic mystery novels for general readers. She lives in the Chicago area. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.